Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
After 3 years of recession, we can now safely say consumer spending is back. It's just a little bit different than it used to be. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Ally Bank, offering sleeping money alerts to notify customers when their money could be doing more. Learn more at allybank.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Tuesday, everybody. It's the 14th of December today. That would be December 2010, of course, which makes it 3 years to the month since the Great Recession started. It has also been, as the Commerce Department reminded us this morning, 3 years since retail sales went in the tank. As of last month, they are back. The Commerce Department said today November retail sales are basically where they were in the fall of 2007. Stores are loving that news, as are economists. Consumer spending is, as we've told you many, many times, a huge engine for the American economy. But unemployment is still pretty high. Personal income has been basically flat. The economy is, at best, a mixed bag. So why all the holiday cheer from consumers? We asked Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith to figure out what's up.
It's not necessarily optimism. Consumers feel pretty much the same about the state of the economy as they did last year. It's just that they're sick and tired of being frugal. And, says retail consultant Candace Corlett, shoppers have gotten used to their new economic situation.
They've had their personal equity and income rocked, but people are settling into a new reality. They've paid down their debt. They've postponed so many purchases that they have to get back to buying some things.
But don't expect a return of the shopaholic of yesteryear. Nancy Kane is a retail expert at Harvard Business School. She says today's consumer is a new animal, and retailers need to recognize that.
Retailers who are clapping their hands need to take a big yoga breath and think about what this means. Because for 10 years, retailers thought about consumer behavior as more is better and new is a must-have. And that ethos is completely gone.
At an outdoor holiday market near Grand Central Station in New York, shopper Tina McCourt says she's being a lot more thoughtful about what she buys her kids, and they're getting fewer gifts.
They're not getting 20 presents. They may get 10 more targeted presents, just things that they specifically really want or need rather than just extraneous items that they may be interested in.
Harvard's Nancy Kane says the new American shopper sets strict spending limits, spends a lot of time comparing prices. They also tend to make lists and check them twice. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
There's a report out today from the Congressional Oversight Panel for the TARP, the bank bailout. It says the Obama administration's mortgage modification program, with the handy acronym of HAMP, is falling short. The White House had hoped to keep 3 to 4 million families from being foreclosed upon. Now it's looking more like 700,000 at best. There are all kinds of problems with the program, including the fact that the Treasury Department won't admit HAMP has a problem. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Maybe there ought to be a 12-step program for the Treasury Department. My name is Timothy Geithner, and my home affordable modification program isn't working too well. So far, though, Treasury officials haven't acknowledged that. They say the program has pushed private lenders to modify more mortgages on their own. Even former Senator Ted Kaufman, who issued today's report, doesn't think the program should be scrapped.
Oh, stick with it, because even for those 700,000 or 800,000 Americans that are going to avoid foreclosure, that's a very important thing.
Unfortunately, 10 times that many, 8 to 13 million Americans, are at risk of losing their homes. And Susan Wachter at the Wharton School says it's going to be tough to help a lot of them because their mortgages were sliced and diced into complex securities.
These are extremely difficult. There are a number of parties, starting with the investors, the second mortgage holders, and the originators themselves.
Still, Wachter says, more needs to be done now to get people's payments down to something they can afford. Otherwise,
when these foreclosures do occur, that is the foreclosures that could have been prevented by modifications or short sales, they could bring us to a second leg down in housing prices, a double dip.
So what more can be done? Richard Green, director of the USC Lusk Center for Real Estate, says future government efforts need to help underwater homeowners by lowering the principal they owe on their mortgages, not just the interest rate.
What that does is it means that people aren't trapped in their houses. They could sell their way out of trouble. Now, when they do that, of course, the lender will take a hit. But again, if the property goes into foreclosure, they're going to lose a whole lot more money.
Plus, create problems for their neighbors and the rest of us. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Yahoo announced today that just in time for the holidays, it's laying off 4% of its workforce, about 600 people. That would still leave the world with about 13,000 Yahoos, as they are known. But it does raise these questions. In the world of Google and Apple, what exactly is Yahoo anyway? And given the company's lackluster growth lately, what's its future? Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
The name may be catchy.
Yahoo!
But it's never been terribly descriptive. What is Yahoo? Forrester research analyst Joanna O'Connell took a stab at that question.
Yahoo is big, and they are an aggregator of audiences, and they are a company that can chop up those audiences in really interesting ways for marketers.
Translation, Yahoo makes its money selling targeted advertising on some of the Internet's most popular destinations. Tom Krazet follows Yahoo for CNET.
If you want to do that kind of advertising, Yahoo is really some place that you have to consider given the size of their properties.
But what is Yahoo's product? Is it search and email technologies, news and information, all of the above?
They were a technology company, and then Terry Semel came in and said he wanted to make it a media company, and then he left, and Jerry Yang said, hey, we want to focus back more on search, and then he left, and Carol Bartz came in and hasn't exactly clarified one way or another exactly what Yahoo wants to be.
In fact, the website TechCrunch asked Carol Bartz, the current CEO, in May, what is Yahoo? She sounded as if the company wanted to be all things to all people.
People come to us to find out what's going on in the world in a very nice, quick fashion, to do their communications through mail and messenger, check in on their teams. We all know about Yahoo Finance. It's a place where you can just get it together.
Which is what analysts say Yahoo needs to do, get it together and focus its business model. Danny Sullivan runs the website Search Engine Land. He says Yahoo can't count on always being a leading web portal.
I think the worrisome thing for them is you've got new people who are coming on who may have no idea what Yahoo is because they start their day at Facebook.
It underscores Yahoo's need to focus on exactly where and how it wants to compete. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
What do you suppose would happen if the Federal Reserve had a meeting on interest rates and nobody noticed? It's pretty much what happened today. The Fed's announcement after its meeting said that interest rates are going to stay where they are. The Fed is going to keep on buying Treasury bills and crossing its fingers. That last part was not in the actual announcement, by the way. On Wall Street today, the Dow hit a two-year high, which sounds great until you realize that that means the blue chips are exactly where they were 2 years ago. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Maybe you've heard about the budget problems the great state of California is having. Even the brand new spending plan the legislature and the governor agreed to just 2 months ago is already billions of dollars in the red. So pretty much anything that gets paid for with state money is being squeezed. This week, the University of California Regents approved limits on how much the school is going to pay for employee retirement and benefit plans, limits that may well be coming soon to a state school near you. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins has more.
Richard Walker has been a professor of geography at the University of California, Berkeley, for 35 years.
Most people, a lot of the faculty, could get higher salaries at a private university. But one of the reasons we stay here is because of the good benefits.
Those benefits are about to change for new employees. The Board of Regents that oversees the UC system voted to push back the retirement age about 5 years and require new employees to pay more for their retirement and health benefits. Jane Wellman of the Delta Project on National Education Costs says public school benefits have been too good for too long.
If we're going to maintain those benefit structures, then it's going to come straight out of the hide of student tuition. And I don't think it's sustainable, and the Regents evidently didn't either.
The UC pension fund was battered during the financial crisis, and California can't afford to cover the estimated $21 billion shortfall in benefit costs.
Those are really eating up more money than institutions and states can afford. And so charging retirees more for their benefits is something that's starting to happen around the country.
That story is familiar to many Americans working in the private sector. Again, Professor Richard Walker.
Some of your listeners may say, oh my goodness, they shouldn't have it so good. But rather, everyone should have a perfectly adequate and comfortable retirement, as we will have, at least my generation will have.
I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
The European Union's in the middle of its annual meetings about expansion, considering whether to extend offers of membership to countries outside its immediate circle. Turkey has been trying to get in for years now. It's been hung up mostly on political issues. But economically, it's doing a whole lot better than some countries that are already in the EU. Greece, Portugal, and Ireland, to name just a few. The Turkish economy has grown by more than 8% this year. It's a far cry from the days of International Monetary Fund bailouts. In the first of two reports, Marketplace's Stephen Beard explores Turkey's turnaround.
On a small hill in Ankara, Turkey's army performs its most sacred duty, guarding the tomb of the Republic's founding father, Kemal Atatürk. More than 80 years ago, he turned this country into a secular, modern-minded, westward-looking state. Today, some say his legacy is in mortal danger.
It's a fight for the soul of the Turkish nation.
Haldun Solmazturk, a retired army general, says the ruling Islamic Party, the AKP, is determined to unravel Atatürk's reforms.
This is their mission, to take this country and move it further to what they call our civilization, meaning the Muslim civilization.
But in spite of such fears of creeping Islamization, the ruling party has proved highly adept at managing the economy and fostering enterprise. This small furniture maker is based in Kayseri in Turkey's Asian heartland, Anatolia. The company is one of the region's booming businesses, the so-called Anatolian Tigers.
The metal beds we are exporting to Switzerland, Germany, Austria.
Shavak Çivici and her family quadrupled their sales to around $4.5 million over the past 4 years. Unusually for an entrepreneur, she and many of her fellow business people here attribute much of their company's growth to the government.
Without this political regime that we have right now, I don't think it would have grown that much. It would have grown, but not that much.
She's benefited from a raft of business-friendly measures like interest-free loans to finance exports. She says the ruling AK party is not trying to turn Turkey into another Iran. It's just encouraging the equivalent of the Protestant work ethic and a conservative, unlavish lifestyle. And that's certainly the norm in this town.
You won't see very many BMWs. You won't find a Porsche. You will not find these fancy, high-life type cars.
They are not ostentatious people.
Yes, they don't like to show off.
There's rather more showing off back here in Istanbul, amid the skyscrapers of the financial district. But even here, there's much less of the opulence of London or New York. Turkey had its financial meltdown 9 years ago. After that, financial regulation of the banks was tightened, the budget deficit reduced. And, claims Surahan Doğan, head of investment banking at the Finance Bank, there's now less of the Western-style excess.
We don't have the sort of bonus system that has been a major trouble in Western economies.
You can't be happy about that as an investment banker, surely?
Well, in the short term, you may resent it, but I guess that is what is securing our long-term employment.
We should not exaggerate the virtues of the Turkish economy. Inflation at 9% is too high. But, says veteran Turkish commentator Sami Cohen, things are better than in Europe.
Greece and Ireland and Portugal are in bad shape. Their economies are in bad shape. And Turkey is doing quite well. So, I mean, now this also adds more to the self-confidence of Turkey.
On the Turkish street, people seem pumped up by the country's relative success. Turkey seems to be giving up its old dream of joining the European Union. and is forging closer links with the Middle East. In Istanbul, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up, how bad gifts can really wind up costing you.
It took up 0.01% of my floor space. And when you multiply that by my rent and by 12 months, it comes out to $1.50 per year.
A little bit of Freakonomics Radio straight ahead, but first, let's do the numbers. Stocks lifted on strong retail spending today and then lost some steam. The Dow Industrials hit a two-year trading high before ending up 47 points, 0.4%, closed at 11,476. The NASDAQ inched up 2 points, about a 10%, finished at 2627. The S&P 500 rose a point, about a 10%, ended things at 1241. Despite the November retail report, investors looked at Best Buy and had only one thought: Best Sell. The electronic chain stock fell nearly 15% after it reported weak quarterly earnings. Radio Shack got dragged down 3% in Best Buy's wake. Other retailers, though, fared better. Bed Bath & Beyond booked a 2.5% gain. Discount chain Costco gained 0.2%. The Federal Reserve affirmed its easy money policy, but bank stocks slid anywho. Citigroup lost 2.5%. JPMorgan Chase withdrew 1.7% today. Confidence in the recovery of insurance and financial giant AIG sent its shares up 0.6%. Bond prices slipped. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.47%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to strengthen America by empowering more young people to achieve educational success beyond high school. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and Progressive.com. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the Producer Price Index for November. The House Judiciary Committee holds a second hearing on causes and effects of the foreclosure crisis. And tomorrow is Bill of Rights Day by presidential proclamation. This is also Human Rights Week. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl, and there you are in the checkout line. You've got your new laptop or DVD player in the cart, and you're all set to check out. And the salesperson brings things to a screeching halt. Would you like, they say, an extended protection plan to supplement the manufacturer's guarantee? And you wonder, do I really need to spend more money on the off chance that this thing is going to go bad? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has more now on the business of buyer protection.
Electronics stores offered extended warranties first. Now all kinds of retailers do, on everything from cars to jewelry. But research from Consumer Reports shows extended warranties are unwarranted. That's because most products don't break during the extended coverage period, which is why extended warranties produce such a great revenue stream for retailers.
Yeah, it's very profitable. It's much richer profit than selling some of the goods.
That's Joe Feldman, a retail analyst at the Telsey Advisory Group. He says Best Buy used to report extended warranty sales. That is, until analysts figured out the chain made half its profits from warranties. They make up for the deep discounts box stores offer. Economists say manufacturers know this, so some have shortened their own standard warranties to make their retailers' extended coverage more appealing. Kevin McCabe heads the Center for the Study of Neuroeconomics at George Mason University.
You want to make a good deal for your retailers, otherwise they won't carry your products.
Best Buy offers extended warranties on almost every product it sells. Linger near the registers, and you'll hear the cashiers offering them repeatedly.
Next in line.
Like at this Best Buy in the Maryland suburbs of Washington, if customers say no, they're pressed further.
It covers our blowouts, anything, damage from dust, overheating, anything.
No, it's okay.
I'm positive. Are you sure? Okay.
Store manager Christopher Anderson says Best Buy isn't trying to scare people into thinking products will break down. It's just offering a valuable service.
It's just giving you the peace of mind and the comfort that you bought it from Best Buy, we're standing behind it, you don't have to worry about anything.
Customer Randy Morgan just plunked down $40 for an extended warranty on a flat-screen TV.
Anything over, I say, $300, $400, I say it's worth it to buy. All my computers, laptops, TVs, and high-end cameras, I buy a warranty with.
Morgan says an extended warranty did pay off for him once when his TV wouldn't turn off. Best Buy came in and fixed it. He says that sense of security is worth paying for. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Time for some Freakonomics Radio. Every couple of weeks, we talk to Stephen Dubner. He's the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name about the hidden side of everything. Hey, Dubner, welcome back.
Thank you very much. You know, I was listening to my radio the other day,
yeah,
and I heard you say this.
Uh-oh.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media, and I'm Kai Ruzdahl with an apology to the e-shoppers among you who might be listening. I took a swipe at online gift-giving the other day. Said there's not much effort or emotion involved in just clicking and gifting.
Now, I'll be honest with you. I was disappointed that you're apologizing. Not enough emotion?
Yeah, I said it. I'll own that.
See, here's the thing. I like the sound of clicking and gifting. That sounds efficient to me. That's what we need to bring to the holidays is more efficiency, less emotion. Let's get rid of that.
Scrooge. But go ahead. I'm listening.
All right. Imagine this. There's something you want, right? So you know what you do? You just ask for it directly. Adults ask. Now, kids do it. They get Santa, but we're not allowed to. And what happens is we get a bunch of junk. That's what happened to Shannon Dobbins. Listener talked to you about a gift that did not exactly set her on fire.
My internal reaction was, great, it's another thing that's going to catch dust in my house. But, of course, my external reaction was, oh, thank you. Just what I wanted.
Now, Shannon is an engineer in Greenville, South Carolina. Her aunt gave her this big candle for Christmas. She didn't like it. She didn't need it.
My power never goes out, and I guess I'm not dating anybody, so I have no need for ambiance.
Now, this was a half-gallon-sized sandalwood-scented beast that just sat there unlit and unloved. Now, there's an economic term for this kind of wasted gift-giving. You know what that is, Kai?
In point of fact, I do, actually. I host a program on business and the economy. Do you know that?
I've heard it on the air once in a while.
So anyway, it's called deadweight loss, right? It's that thing where my wife's great-grandma buys me a sweater at $85, and to me it's worth like $1.50 because it just, I don't like it.
All right, so that's $83.50 deadweight loss,
right?
Exactly. And the holidays are jam-packed with that kind of waste. Now, Shannon, as an engineer, she spends her days crunching numbers. So we asked her to do a little bit of math to calculate the waste on this horrible candle her aunt gave her.
I would say that it took up 0.01% of my floor space. And when you multiply that by my rent and by 12 months, it comes out to $1.50 per year. Now, for the mental space that it takes up in my life, I would say that I regret having it maybe 3 times a week.
I love that image of her looking at the thing 3 times a week for 5 seconds saying, oh, I regret this.
And she can't stop herself, apparently, right?
That's right.
So she may have some issues besides the candle, but the fact is there's a lot of waste going on. The $25 she estimates her aunt spent on the candle, it costs Shannon, in her mind, money to keep it around. Now multiply this by everyone across America every year, massive deadweight loss, right? So to put an end to this insanity, I propose to you, Kai, the Freakonomics Holiday Gift Registry, a place where anybody can ask everybody else directly for what they want.
But here's the thing. This is the American retail industry's worst nightmare because people won't be going into the stores. They won't be making the impulse buys. They won't be doing all that spending off the cuff that needs to stimulate the economy.
wrong. I'm not saying people shouldn't buy gifts, just that they shouldn't buy horrible, unwanted, wasteful gifts. That's all.
But it's the thought that counts, right?
You know, I was afraid you'd say that. I checked with an expert, Viviana Zelizer, who's an economic sociologist at Princeton. She actually studies the meaning of gift giving.
You should not have to ask, because if you ask, it means you are spelling out what kind of relationship you have. And part of gift giving is discovering it.
Yeah, so I hate to say it. Zelizer kind of persuaded me that society might just not be ready for my brilliant idea yet.
So the registry's on hold then, yes?
Yeah, and unfortunately. Give me till next year. I'm going to try to work out some kinks. In the meantime, though, I sent you a little something, Kai. You got a box there?
I do, and you know what? This is my favorite part of this segment, because it seems like every time I go on the radio with you, I get something. I kept the $5, by the way, from the lottery thing. I kept that.
I've noticed.
All right. Should I open this?
If you dare open right, it, you should right, open it. Now, keep in mind, I did not have a registry.
And as you can see, I'm enthusiastically ripping it open. I hate you. So it is, you know that I'm a Yankees fan, and you sent me a Boston Red Sox Santa Claus hat.
Oh, gosh, I guess I forgot you're a Yankees fan. Kai, I am so sorry.
Pure deadweight loss you're... here, Dubner. Pure deadweight loss.
Maybe just dead, but right. Maybe now you're convinced of the need for a registry. Next year you want to let me help you give you a better gift, huh,
all right,
Kai?
Fine. I'm sold. Stephen Dubner, Freakonomics Radio. You can find more at his website. It's freakonomicsradio.com. We'll see you.
See you later, Kai.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Microsoft, providing comprehensive business solutions for the cloud. You can learn more at microsoft.com/cloud. Marketplace is supported by Novo Nordisk. Since 1923, innovative developer of diabetes treatments and delivery devices at novonordisk-us.com. And by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, which comes with a shout-out to our friends at Planet Money. Did you ever wonder why the American real estate market is so messed up? Well, here's one reason. Freddie Mac has a calculator on its website that helps people decide whether it makes sense to rent a place or to buy a house. You enter your data, it spits out the answer, which is great, except for this. Until just recently, the calculator assumed home prices would never go down. That's been fixed. And with that, that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Tuesday. Today, the Dow gained 47 points, about 0.4%. The NASDAQ inched up 2 points, 0.1%. The S&P 500 rose a single point, about 0.1%. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay and Jolie Podokas on our Morning Report crew. Yes, she got married. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid, and that is where you can tune tomorrow to hear the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this broadcast...
We feel rejected, and I just am not happy with that.
Tired of the EU's cold shoulder, Turkey is taking its business elsewhere. I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.